Welcome to the Book Tree Podcast. What should your kids and teens be reading next? To answer that question, we'll be interviewing authors and illustrators, publishers and literacy experts, and other bookish people. We'll also look at current book news and trends and discuss issues around reading and writing. We'll look at the most burning question on all our minds. How do we get kids to read in these screen-obsessed times? Hosted by me, Corinne Rosmarin, journalist and writer. This is a home for all things books, children's and parents' books. After all, children become readers when they see their parents reading too. Come and join us, and let's find out what your kids and you should be reading next.
Welcome to the Book Tree Podcast.
Welcome to episode 8 of the Book Tree Podcast. Did you know that books can heal, and that sometimes reading is all the therapy you might need? Of course you do, you're a reader. Do you ever have the feeling, though, that when you're reading the book, it is exactly the right book at the right time for you? Like the topic is spot on, the storyline, the message, the characters, they speak to you. When I look back at some of the books that I really loved as a child, I see a common theme was a feeling of loneliness and isolation. And I realized that with books that I loved, such as The Secret Garden, the main character's loss and isolation spoke to a deep loneliness that I was feeling. And her subsequent blossoming felt like a balm, like a release for me. Without even knowing what I was doing, I was seeking out books that fed me and that spoke to me in a certain way. And stories like this can make you feel seen. They connect with you. They move you. And they help you to process things that you might not have found the words of your own to express. We know that words have power. I'm not talking about nonfiction books or self-help books, although they can be excellent. And I know that some books that I've read, like Eckhart Tolle's books and Dr. Wayne Dyer's books, which are self-help manuals, so to say, they've given me many epiphanies and have really changed my life. But I'm talking about fiction books or nonfiction books that offer insights and help you to see life on another level that you connect with. So I've always known about this, but I didn't realize there was actually a whole study of it and actually a practice of it. And this is called bibliotherapy. It's a real thing. It's basically using books as therapy, and it falls under the same set as art therapy, which is also something I believe in. In fact, this year I've been practicing watercolor painting with a group of girlfriends. We get together once a month and we follow YouTube tutorials. And just having that unstructured fun and stress release has been so wonderful. But going back to bibliotherapy, I was lucky enough to interview Bijal Shah. She's a bibliotherapist and an author from the UK, and I can't wait for you to listen to the interview. As an introduction to her work, she is a bibliotherapist, a counsellor, and an author. She is the founder of Book Therapy, which offers individual, couples, and group bibliotherapy. She curates literary reading lists, and she gives you personalised reading services. She also offers bibliotherapy training. Her book recommendations have featured in The Guardian, Marie Claire, NBC News, BBC Culture, and many other publications. She's also a member of the International Federation of Library Associations and the American Library Association. She is the author of The Happiness Mindset, which was published in 2014, and her latest book, Bibliotherapy, The Healing Power of Reading, which was published in February 2024. Bijal, welcome to the Book Tree Podcast.
Thank you so much, Corinne, for having me. It's a delight. And, I love speaking to other book lovers and people promoting the power of reading, whether that's healing or whether that's whatever it is. And I know you have a specific focus on children's literature, which is wonderful.
Yes, we do. I think it's really important to start with the children, and that's something that we find in South Africa, that we have to focus more on getting our children to read. I would imagine that you have the same issue in London, in the UK.
Yeah, we do. Look, I think it's the adolescent stage, you know, but after the ages of 10 to 17, a lot of kids drop off, especially boys. So that's a big problem issue that we're looking to tackle here. And, you know, there've been alarm warnings from lots of different agencies on that specifically. It is a growing issue.
I do. I think it's an issue around the world. But looking at what you do, I love the angle you're coming in on, because you're actually promoting the use of books as a healing tool, as a tool to help you. So for those who don't know, bibliotherapy is written or described as a therapeutic approach that uses books and other literature to support a person's emotional, psychological, and mental health.
It involves guiding reading of materials to gain understanding and help with problem solving and promoting well-being through books. So, if that captures everything, is there something what you want to add?
Look, I think you've captured it in a nutshell. It really is a subset of art therapy. We use the literature very much as a prompt to help guide and offer clues into some of the things that we're grappling with on a day-to-day basis. Things that are resonating with us, are often things that we need to explore. And sometimes it's easier to give us that language. A book offers that language up quite easily than sometimes even a therapist does. And the risk of, judgment isn't there sometimes. Even with a therapist or another person, we sometimes feel like we can't openly share what we're thinking. But if there's already a story or a narrative that you can plug into, that's really helpful. And that's how I tend to work with literature. I use fiction or nonfiction, doesn't have to be nonfiction self-help, which might be the first thought that people have. But in fact, I use a lot of fiction in my work, and that often tends to be more powerful than nonfiction, even because there's a narrative, there's a story, there's, a lot more emotional language. The stories are often character-driven, which allows people to empathize with the character. It also allows them to be seen, see themselves in the character. And all of those are things that are really powerful when you're working in a sort of therapeutic setting. The great thing about books is you don't necessarily need to, go and see a counselor. You can actually do some self-bibliotherapy work, do some reflective journaling, or some of the other techniques that I teach in my online courses as well that people can use to help themselves. They didn't want to see a counselor. And I think it's great for people who, A, don't have the time or the resource or, the financial means to see somebody as well. And that's really my goal with bibliotherapy, is just to allow people to really sort of go out there and help themselves and see reading in a different light and see it as a tool for empowerment, for development, for therapeutic healing, for processing emotions, all those great things.
Wow. Just so I understand then, because I've only read about bibliotherapy, how would it work in a practical example? Let's give a case where a parent would come to you, obviously, and say, my child is really battling with anxiety at school, and she's absolutely fine when she's home, but the minute she has to go out to school, be with all her peers, she really falls apart. How would you then take it from there?
There's a great picture book that comes to mind, When Were You Worried, which I tend to use a lot. And I essentially sit with the child in a one-to-one setting, and I often, we'll read the book together, but then I'll often get them to perhaps draw something or play with some characters or some toys, giving the characters names, etc., and just see what comes up for them, see how they feel, give them a few prompts about what did you like about the book? Very sort of open-ended questions. How are you feeling right now after reading this? Was there anything that you particularly remember from the book? Or we'll go through the pages. So it's very much doing it in a non-direct way, where we're sort of looking to open up some conversations. And if they don't want to talk, then looking to get them to draw a few things on a piece of paper or use toys. Essentially, with children, it's a little bit different to adults. They don't always have the language, or they don't find it easy to talk about it. So we use other means, drawing or toys or sound play or even drama. We do sometimes act out the story because I think that's really helpful for kids.
So it's a version of play therapy, it sounds like.
Yeah, it is. Exactly. It's using a story that's already in place, but bringing that into play therapy, because that story is important to give them the language, or to give them the permission to talk about something, or to just help them make it easier for them, really.
Would you prompt them to sort of say, something like, Wembley's worried. Do you think he needs to be worried? Or are you just kind of like asking questions about the character? It's easier for them because it's not saying, are you worried? You're just talking about a character and diverting it from
Exactly.
him.
Yeah, they find, even adults, like we all find it easier to talk about ourselves through the character. And often you'll just the kids will be saying it and they're talking about themselves because it's just coming from their own lens. You just kind of go with it, but it's very easy for children to do that. They just get into character very quickly. It's a great technique to use with children, especially for parents. My practice is very child-led, so I'll let them choose the book sometimes. I'll might give them some choices. And if they want to reread some books over and over again, that's fine as well, because it means that they haven't quite finished learning what they needed to learn from that book, or there's something else that they're looking to explore. So it's totally fine. You know, as adults or parents will be like, oh, you've read that, should we read this now? But it doesn't matter. Like, if they need to reread something 4 or 5 times, that's fine. You know,
That's a
it's
good point,
important.
because I think often we as parents will kind of feel we're tired of the story, so we'd love to have a new one, but children will have their favorite. And as you say, there's something about that story that they're still getting, that they're still learning from it or enjoying. So you just have to keep with it.
Yeah, exactly. You just have to persevere, be patient, let it be child-led for sure.
And what was your own journey with books as a child? Did you find yourself turning to books as a child?
Yes, I mean, look, I grew up in Kenya, so not far from South Africa, and at the time we'd rely heavily on the community libraries there and the school libraries as well. It wasn't like there was that much. I mean, there was stuff to do, but you know, I'd often find myself in the library, you know, left to browse at my own will. And I think that really sort of helped me build up that love for reading, because I'd find all these stories that I could just go in and explore and dive into. And you know, I grew up in a sort of Jain community, and it was lovely, Jainism. But there were certain things that were taboo that weren't talked about, like mental health was completely unheard of. You turn to religion if something's bothering you, but you don't actually talk about the feeling, like anxiety or anger, or, you know, it's a very peace-loving religion as well. So emotions like anger are very suppressed, resentment, all of those things are kind of really not talked about. So, you know, books kind of brought in those other angles and those other outlets that weren't necessarily that easy to find. So that really was the thing that cemented my love for reading, but also, you know, the reason why I sort of return to books so often. And it was only later in life that I came to discover this term, bibliotherapy. And you know, that's probably what I've been doing all my life, and that most of us do actually without realizing it. But it's that sort of that shock of recognition, or that surprise element when we do realize, oh, this is what I've been doing all along. You know, it's quite wonderful to have that feeling resonate. So yeah, it's sort of how I began. And then I worked in banking for a long time, but I was always fascinated by people, and more so when I was working in banking, that led me to do this part-time diploma in counseling. And when you're doing training like that, you have to be in therapy yourself, because that's how you learn. So I
Okay.
found myself using literature a lot in my own sessions, therapy sessions, counseling sessions, and then I would take in books to do the sessions, and eventually ended up researching it and discovered that there was all of this academic research on books, but also a whole history of therapeutic reading going all the way back to the ancient Greeks, even the ancient Egyptians, to Montaigne in the 15th century, and then obviously Wordsworth. And
Do you mean to say that the idea of bibliotherapy has existed for centuries?
the concept of turning to literature and scriptures for healing has existed for centuries. And even in the ancient Egyptian times, there was the house for the soul, and it was really just a chamber that held lots of books, you know,
Wow.
even some physical medicine. So you know, we all recognize the importance of the power of words, even if it wasn't necessarily in book format, even if it was just scripture. Over time, reading, writing has evolved, right, from different genres. So we had these sort of the ancient Greek Stoicism philosophy, which really informs cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. In fact, it's a direct, that is what CBT actually is.
Oh,
You
really?
know,
From
it's,
Stoics. Okay.
and I write about this whole history in my book,
Yeah.
Bibliotherapy, The Healing Power of Reading. But, you know, and then the genre develops into tragedy and comedy used by the ancient Greeks to process some of the really difficult things that we all face, right? So they kind of gave birth to those genres. And then you have the early novels, and you have Montaigne's like personal essay style. Like, you know, his essays often felt like, when you read them, you often feel like he's writing about you. So that self-exploration that happens in his essay, he probably gave birth to the personal essay. So you know, you come across these genres over time that are really elements of both therapeutic reading and writing. And then Shakespeare uses a lot of comedy and tragedy in his work. You have Wordsworth. This is just the Western aspects that I'm talking about. And then there's a lot in ancient Indian philosophy as well. And I actually have a course that's just dedicated to the ancient Indian Rasa theory philosophy, talking about books and literature. But there is sort of this history, but that's very untold and not so heard about in literature. So my goal with writing the book was to bring about that research so people can read about it. And then, of course, I wanted to pioneer what had been done by earlier academics in the 1950s. Because again, during the World Wars, poetry therapy was used a lot, and hospitals had libraries attached to them, and doctors would be poets as well. Yeah, there's been a lot of use of this, but probably quite fragmented. And so my goal here at Book Therapy is to sort of, it's a mission to spread awareness of it, to pioneer it in my own practice using research studies by academics, because lots of people are studying this at university level across the world, in India, Iran, Brazil, the UK, like everywhere. And so it's nice to take the work and the research of some of the studies and the techniques that they've used and to put it together for people. So I use a lot of that stuff. I mean, I do have an online course that kind of pulls together a lot of these techniques as well.
Tell us about your online course because this is sounding very interesting and I think I may be signing up for it.
I'm just sharing the awareness that I'm looking to spread. And
Absolutely, tell me.
we have about six courses, online courses. One's our signature bibliotherapy, literature, and mental health course, which covers some of the things that I mentioned. And it's very much from a Western angle, but it talks about bibliotherapy, my methodology that I use, and then the different techniques that I use and the different genres and what's used for what, as well as some client stories. And some of that's also in the book. And then there's the children's bibliotherapy skills course, which is a little bit different. It's very much targeted for children, so that might be something you'd be interested in. And it's working with children in educational settings as well. And then I also have a Raising a Reader and Storyteller course, which is more for 0 to 10, parents who want to get their children into reading at a young age. So those are the three. And then I have one on the Indian philosophy, Indian Rasa theory and bibliotherapy, of how we use ancient Indian literature in therapeutic reading and bibliotherapy. And then I also have a group one, group bibliotherapy, which is if you wanted to work in groups, if you're like a group therapist or a group life coach or something, and you wanted to bring that element of literature into your practice. And then also, just for the sports lovers, I had one on books and tennis,
Oh, wow.
because tennis performance coaching, life coaching actually comes from tennis performance coaching. So a lot of the practices and mindsets that you see in tennis kind of inform life coaching. And I wanted to talk about some of those strategies that we can all use, and also some of the fiction and non-fiction found in literature, which with a focus on tennis, is actually quite helpful for course participants. So yeah,
Can
so
you
that was
give me an
kind of
example of that? Like, how would that work? Is it a book about tennis? I'm not sure I'm understanding.
yeah. So for example, you have David Foster Wallace's books. He's written some amazing literature, and he actually has string theory, is it string theory? I can't remember the name, but on tennis itself. And it's just this amazing piece on tennis. And when you're on court, the way you play tennis on court is the way you're approaching life as well. You're hitting the ball in someone else's court, you're waiting for it to come back, what you're thinking in that time, because it's such a mental game as well. It's not just a physical game, because you're like thinking fast on your toes, you're making lots of decisions. And so a lot of tennis literature, actually, like fiction as well, kind of depicts the thought processes when they're describing tennis in the language. So it's nice to sort of use that as a prompt for discussion, as a tool. And also there's also the non-fiction stuff as well. So non-fiction literature as well, that's really useful. And that comes in from a more coaching mindset. We use some of that as a guide as well. So I cover those books and pieces in the course as well. But it's also, just for people who are tennis lovers, there's a whole history and cultural aspect to it as well.
I'm not a tennis player, although I do have a dream of going to Wimbledon, which is coming up soon. So, but I do have an interest in reaching young boys and getting them to read. And I'm just interested in this use of a sport like tennis and these kind of books that apply life coaching principles to sports, or looking at
Yes.
sports, I should say,
Yeah.
as an a metaphor for, how you approach life. And I'm thinking that could be very valuable, a really good way of reaching young boys and girls. Anyone who has a sports focus that perhaps they don't love reading so much, maybe that's just the way to reach them is to say, well, you love sports. Try these books. Maybe a parent could read some of the books to the children. I don't know. Just made my mind think about it.
No, absolutely. Look, video games, sports, all of those things are like, I mean, some video games have even been approved for treating depression, and I think it's very similar to sports as well, in terms of what it can do for the brain and the brain pathways and just the mental discipline as well. So I think you're 100% right. Like, I mean, that the course is more for adults, but I think teenagers could also do the course because they have more time to read. So I
Yes.
do think they could actually benefit from reading and doing that course and reading the literature in that course. Yeah, absolutely.
Are there some books that you think that every child should be reading that you find yourself recommending over and over again to parents?
Again, it depends on the age group because the ages for children change so much. So every for 9 to 10, it's different. For 12 to 13, it's different to 16 to 18. But I often look at the books that really helped me when I was younger, and I loved for teenage girls, Judy Blume, Little Women, Louisa May Alcott. I absolutely thought those were brilliant books. For boys, I would definitely say, like, for adolescent boys or teenagers, read Dostoevsky if you can, because he is sometimes I feel like he's even more brilliant than Freud. And he does talk about moral ambiguity and the moral dilemmas that we all face. And I think as adolescents are forming our identities still, I think books, Dostoevsky's books, are brilliant in helping us question things, challenge things, think critically, but also think about what's the right thing to do. As teenagers, we're presented with so many different choices, but it allows us, his literature often allows us to reflect on those choices and think about which one am I going to go down. His literature doesn't really judge us in the same way that maybe Freud would. In some, he talks about, in Crime and Punishment, and he talks about the dilemma that the character's facing and why they behaved immorally, but it's not so clear cut, and it's not so black and white.
Which is also
So
great to get kids to think creatively and perhaps go into the ethics of things that we do in life, and that creative thinking is so important these days.
it's so important, and we don't get to practice it often. Or enough. But I do have these reading lists on my website. They're free. They're just like arranged by different mental health themes, similar to how it is. Like, the back of my book has an A to Z of reading lists arranged by mental health themes, from anxiety, depression, midlife crisis for adults. For children, I have something similar, from bullying to, transition to change to moving home to moving countries, things for teenagers as well. So that might be helpful for parents as well.
I'll definitely put a link up on my site with this because I think that would be amazing. Let's just go back to your book. You said that the paperback version is coming out. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
The paperback's coming out in September. The hardback came out last year. Between now and then, we've had it been translated into 10 other languages, so Chinese, Portuguese, Turkish, Hungarian, Slovenian, a lot of Eastern European ones. But look, the paperback is now out, so I'm really excited to get this out into more people's hands. I'm hoping that it's going to be, a cheaper version of the hardback, so more people can get their hands on it. But it's available on, all bookstores. Should be in South Africa as well when it comes out on September the 5th, plus other Commonwealth countries, the UK. The US one's just coming out in June, actually, the hardback, and then the paperback's out in December. But if you're struggling anywhere in the world, just go to Blackwell's UK and they do free shipping. So
Oh, brilliant.
that's
Okay.
what.
Blackwell's UK. I'll put that on the site.
I think for parents, I think here what's resonated is that they can give their child a book and say, look, this is the value of reading. It's not just for entertainment, but also for healing and for therapy. And so a lot of parents and like gifting that book to their kids, especially the ones that are old enough to read it, like teenagers. But I do think it's just generally a helpful resource for anybody who is struggling and doesn't always have access to a therapist or a counselor because it's a book that you can pick up for an issue and here it is,
I
kind of
love
thing.
that. I always say there's a book for everything, you know. There's a book for everything and everyone. And sometimes when you read a story, you find a depiction of something that you've been thinking about or going through, and you sort of access it through a character's eyes, and you see how they've judged it or they are going through it. It just helps you so much more than someone dealing with it through your eyes and saying, "Well, Corinne, you should be doing this." And I'm always
Yes.
amazed because I'm a big underliner. I have a highlight pen and I underline my books. That's why I like hard copy of books. And I love
Yeah.
saving little quotes. So I completely believe in this whole idea of quotes and poetry and words being healing and powerful.
Oh, words are so powerful. How you arrange them, so key. We're just all word arrangers, really. But it's just so crucial because they give language to the symbols and symbolism that and meaning that's in our head, and such a way to reconcile with each other. It's wonderful.
It is. You don't feel so alone once you've read a story. You kind of have this feeling of
No.
connecting with the character and everyone else who's reading it.
It's like you found these familiar friends, in these
Absolutely.
books. That has an effect on the brain. It does. Imagination has a similar effect, like when you're imagining a story. The same pathways of the brain light up as though we were imagining it in real life, like truly happening to us.
You are actually accessing a deep healing then through that, through just reading the
You
word.
are. You are. I think we often feel so resolved after reading something. So that, I mean, there's the proof, right? There's the evidence in itself.
Well, I'm going to be buying the book definitely. I'll be putting in my order and I will put up the name of the book and all the details on my website. Thank you so much for giving me
Stop.
the time today. It was lovely to chat.
No, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure, and I look forward to staying in touch and for the wonderful work that you're doing. So keep that up.
It's time to dive into the pages of the book review.
Time for book reviews. I have three middle grade books for children aged between 6 and 12. And I also am going to review a book in verse for young adults, which I absolutely loved and read in one night. But before I get to those, I want to actually address the Percy Jackson phenomena. Because whenever I ask a librarian or a bookseller for the best loved series for children aged around 10 plus, they invariably will say Percy Jackson and the Olympians by Rick Riordan. For those of you who don't know, Percy Jackson is a 12-year-old semi-god who discovers he's the son of a Greek god, Poseidon. No pressure. I was intrigued to find out more about the author, Rick Riordan, and what I found out is that he actually had never intended to write a children's book. But then, because of his ADHD and dyslexia, his second-grade son was having a really tough year at school, and as a father, he was trying to reach out to him. He could see his son didn't enjoy reading or writing, but he did love Greek mythology. So Rick decided to build a whole series around mythological tales based on facts of the Olympians. But obviously, from there, he went on a tangent. So he made up his own series, and that was Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, which is the first book. Rick Riordan has said that his goal is to make children have so much fun they don't realize they're learning, which is very powerful. And I think that's the whole aim and sort of the idea of reading is that you shouldn't be sitting there thinking, I'm having to learn this, I'm hating this. It should be entertaining and it should be fun. And that's where I think some books for children don't work, is that they don't feel entertaining and fun. They do feel like they're hard work. So I think that might be part of the success behind the Percy Jackson series. But I decided to find out a bit more, and I spoke to my sister-in-law, Tess Rayner. She is the co-founder and co-principal of Akasha School in Johannesburg. Akasha is a strengths-based school. They are inspired by nature, and they offer an alternative to mainstream education. Their tagline, Brave Learning, which I love, speaks to the entrepreneurial real-life experiences that they gain, as well as the courage it takes to school differently. Because let's face it's just so easy to send your children to the usual school, either the one that's in the neighborhood or the closest school that you find all your peers are sending their children to. So Tessa started the school together with her friend, and her own son, 12-year-old Tom, is also attending the school, and he is racing through the series. So I got Tess to interview him and find out why he is loving this series.
Hi, I'm here with Tom. He's 12 years old and he's busy reading
the Percy Jackson and the Olympian series. So, Tom, what first got you into the Percy Jackson series?
I watched the movie Percy Jackson, The Lightning Thief, which inspired me to read the series.
And was the movie any good?
Yes, it was about as good as the book, but the book has more detail.
Is Percy Jackson your favourite character?
No, it's actually Grover Underwood. What I like about him is he's a loyal friend and he's funny.
And is he human?
No, he's a satyr, which means he is half human, half goat.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Tom, what do you really like about the series?
I like how it mixes Greek mythology with the modern world and how the characters feel real.
What kind of kid do you think would like this series?
I think the kind of kid that would like this series is a kid that likes action, adventure, monsters and mythology. I suppose it's also a good book for kids who feel like they don't quite fit in.
Tom, did you know a lot about Greek mythology before you started the Percy Jackson series?
No, I didn't know a lot about Greek mythology before I read the series, but I've learned a lot.
I know that the Percy Jackson series has a lot of dangerous monsters that Percy Jackson fights. Do you have any that are your least favorites that you would definitely not want to face in a battle?
Yes, I would not want to fight Typhon, which is the father of all monsters. A hydra, which if you chop off one head, it grows two back. And a Scythian Dracaena, which I don't even know how to describe.
Is there any advice that you would give to someone starting the first Percy Jackson book?
Yes. At first it's hard to get into, but keep reading. It'll get easier.
Do you have a favourite book in the series?
Yes, it's probably Percy Jackson and the Battle of the Labyrinth, which is the fourth book. It's my favourite because it was entertaining and I didn't know what was going to happen next.
I've read that Percy Jackson has ADHD and dyslexia. Is this true? And if so, do they help him?
Yes, it is true, and they do help him. The ADHD gives him amazingly fast reflexes, and believe it or not, the dyslexia helps him read Greek.
That is so cool. Last question. If you had to describe the series to a friend in three words, what would those three words be?
Fun, action and adventure.
Thank you, Tom. That was a very eloquent review, and I'm sure you will entice many other young readers to try the Percy Jackson series. This month, I have three middle grade books for children aged between 6 and 12. I'll also be reviewing a young adult book. The first two books I'm reviewing are local. Bongi Ballerina Takes a Bow by Christine Porchita and published by Lapa Publishers is recommended for ages 9 to 12. You may remember the Bongi Ballerina first book, and that is when Bongi decides that she might like ballet after all, after her mother has encouraged her to try ballet. Bongi's a very different child. She likes things that are weird and spooky and scary, so she doesn't think she'll like ballet. By the second book, we've realized that even though she loves being weird, she enjoys her ballet classes because she feels like her friends and her teacher get her. Now, she's not one of those girls who's scared of stuff like spiders or bugs or ghosts, and that might be a stereotype, but it is worth challenging. In fact, Bongi loves everything that is scary, creepy, and spooky. She doesn't love princesses, sparkles, and fairies, but she loves ballet. The theme in the second book follows the idea of a ghost haunting their new rehearsal theatre. So what happens is the children find out that they're going to have a performance of Cinderella. And at first, Bongi's not very impressed, but then she finds out she's going to be wearing an eye-catching green grasshopper costume. She's thrilled. She loves the rehearsals, but then there starts to be these rumors of a ghost. Snacks and costumes are going missing. There's strange sounds coming from the storeroom. And at the same time, her best friend Tamsin starts to act a little strange. She runs away when they want to talk to her. She doesn't seem to turn up in time for her practice, even though she's playing the main part. And eventually, everything comes to a head in a hilarious performance Tamsin doesn't appear on stage in time for her solo, and because everyone has the same idea at the same time to go onto the stage and do their dance over again, they all end up bumping into each other and there's chaos. And on top of it, the pumpkin, which is meant to be the pumpkin carriage that becomes the famous carriage that takes away Cinderella, suddenly starts to move, and then weird noises start to come out of it. And suddenly they realize that there is something or someone inside the pumpkin. I won't give away the rest of it because that is the whole story, but I will say it's a fun book. It is well written. I love the illustrations by Christy Zinn. They really bring the story to life. And I think it's a very good book as a first or second chapter book. It really is easy to read. I like the front. I like the way that some of the words are highlighted. And I think that children will enjoy the story. The second book I'm reviewing is Vampy the Flying Guinea Pig. This is by Laurie Ann Preston with illustrations by Theodore Key. It's also published by LARPA Publishers. They seem to be doing wonderful local books for children in this age group. Flint is not a fan of freaky things, very different from the book we've just reviewed. He likes to be indoors. He likes to play on his iPad, but his mom forces him to go outdoors over the weekend. Flint's friend Zuko loves creepy things. And since Flint has to be outdoors, Zuko suggests they go and check out the haunted house in the neighborhood. Imagine Flint's shock when he finds a vampire guinea pig, a very cute one, but still a vampire guinea pig, one who talks with an Afrikaans accent, has fangs, and can fly. Now, I have to say that I think this is one of my favorite characters in a children's book that I've ever come across. The dialogue from this Afrikaans vampire guinea pig is nothing short of hilarious. Laurie Ann Preston has completely gotten the dialogue and the conversation between Flint and his vampy spot on. I'll give you an example. This is chapter 12. Uh-oh. What? No way, said Flint. I can't take a vampire to school. I'll get kicked out. Yeah, it's a brilliant idea. Even if I do say so myself, said Vampy, completely ignoring Flint's distress. It's been years since I've been to school. How old are you? Asked Flint. I'm 560 years old, said Vampy. We vampires never die, you know. Yo, that's really old. Never, but how rude. But no, you can't come to school with me, said Flint. Pets aren't allowed. And besides, you can't be out in the sun. Aha, no worries about that. It's most going to be raining tomorrow, but... This kind of dialogue and the way that they interact, it just makes the story come alive. And I think that it's one of my favorite characters. And the rest of this funny, delightful, bonkers adventure just follows from there on how Flint works out how he's going to keep this dodgy new pet. And also, why is somebody trying to catch this new pet? Could he be very valuable? Another great sub-story is the way that Vampy defends Flint from the sort of chief bully at the school called Bowden. Every time Bowden tries to pick on him, the vampire bat suddenly gets really angry and bites him on the bum. And no one can work out why he's suddenly screaming. He'll say things, this is the bully, I've just been bitten on my bum bum. And everyone looks at him as if to say, well, you must be mad. And then Bowden realizes that Flint has got something to do with it, but doesn't understand. So he says things like, did you just pinch my bum? I'll pulverize you into cow dung. The class gasped. Wasn't me, smirked Flint, holding up his hands. Perhaps you've got a bum rash, suggested Amira. Bum rash, chanted the class. Bowden immediately leapt into karate stance, ready to knock Flint's block off. Luckily, the bell rang. There's lots of twists and turns in the story, from the mysterious man who seems to be trying to catch the flying guinea pig, Vampy, to also the subplots of the children discovering who Vampy is, and also Flint's sister, Crystal, who's getting more and more suspicious as time goes by as to why Flint is suddenly so preoccupied and not bothering her anymore. I love the illustrations, which are by Theodore Key, and I think this is a wonderful book to entice children to read. It's not a first chapter book. It's longer than that, but it's definitely good for children who don't love reading. It'll capture them. It's easy to read, and it's funny, which is the number one rule. With June being Pride Month, the last book I wanted to review is a book called Julian is a Mermaid. It's not new. It came out in 2018, but I always recommend it when a parent asks for a book that helps a child to understand themselves or their gay family and friends. The story is about a little boy called Julian, and it's very image-driven. The pictures are beautiful. They take up the whole page. Julian is a little boy who loves mermaids, like loves them. He dreams of being a mermaid, in fact. And one day, while he's reading his book, he has a long daydream that he is a mermaid. When he gets home, he decides to dress up as a mermaid. He puts ferns and flowers in his hair. He wears lipstick and he drapes a curtain as a mermaid body. His grandmother, Abuelo, walks in on him dressing up. And at first she looks cross, but then we see that she's just been thinking. Julian's face in the meantime has fallen and he looks like he's in trouble. But then she hands him a necklace and she says, it's for him. And he is delighted. She takes him by the hand and leads him to what looks like a carnival, where everyone is dressed up in fabulous outfits. And she says, like you, honey, let's join them. The joy in the little boy's face as he joins the drag artists all dressed up. It's a heartwarming moment of acceptance and self-discovery. And I think it's one of those books that really can cross bridges between children who don't understand other children who like to dress up, or just for children who might be confused about the adults in their life. And at the end of the day, all the child needs is love and acceptance. The age group for this book is between 6 to 9 year old. It's called Julian is a Mermaid, and it's written by Jessica Love. Our last book review is a young adult book recommended for ages 13 plus. It's called Where the Heart Should Be by Sarah Crossan and published by Bloomsbury. I have never really enjoyed a book that is written in verse as much as this one, and I wasn't sure when I first received it to review if I would enjoy it or not. But it is written so beautifully, so poetically, that even if you have a block against reading, you know, books in verse, I think you should try it. The story revolves around a young Irish girl and a British boy. It's set at the time of the Great Potato Famine in 1845. This was in Ireland, and it was a fungus that attacked the potato crops. And because of this, a huge famine unfolded over the next 2 or 3 years. The British government, which was ruling Ireland at the time, failed to properly assist and help the Irish who were starving. And in fact, they added to the problems by exporting most of the food from Ireland to Britain, even while the people were starving. Nell is this young Irish girl. She's forced to work as a scullery maid for a British landlord who owns her family's farm. And she slowly but surely falls in love with the British heir to his land. He's a young 17-year-old boy who's been told that he has to come and work for his uncle because he is going to inherit the farm one day. But he has little idea of what's really happening in Ireland. And as their relationship grows, you see his confusion. All he wants to do is go out with her and go horse riding and have fun with her. And she's trying to explain to him that her life is so, so different from his. You know, when she sees the dog eating the leftover meat, while she knows her friends and neighbors are starving, she's resentful, but she's also starting to realize that he has his own issues. And chief of those is that his uncle is actually abusive. So the story follows their romance. They have torn loyalties, especially for Nell. She is trying to balance doing everything she can to keep her family together while still following her heart. This is the Carnegie Medal winner Sarah Crossan's first historical novel in verse. And I couldn't put the book down. It felt like reading someone's intimate diary. She writes beautifully. Free verse is more than a poem. It allows drama and poetry and introspection. It gives the story a certain pace. And it's very powerful because whichever words are selected really stand out and they're amplified because of the sparseness of the text. It's a very absorbing time in the history of Ireland, and this heartbreaking reality that is shared is almost like a history lesson, but it's also a love story. So I loved it on every single level. And that's a wrap for this issue. Thanks again to Bijal Shah. Please check out our website for information on where to find out about her work and also her new book that's out. Please share this podcast if you think anyone would enjoy it. Give us a follow. It means the world to me. Also, leave a review. Let me know what else you'd like to talk about in the future. On that note, our next podcast will be looking at how to inspire creativity in children. We're going to look at why creativity and imagination is the magic ingredient that every child needs and every adult going forward, considering that creative thinking is the one human characteristic that will make you stand out in the world of AI. Until then, happy reading.